Hi, I'm Jerry Valancourt. We'll start today by turning to the editorial and opinion newsletters of The Atlantic Monthly, published on July 5th. Written by Mitt Romney, the piece is titled, America is in Denial. Too many Americans are blithely dismissing threats that could prove cataclysmic. Mr. Romney is a Republican senator from Utah and was the Republican nominee for president in 2012. Even as we watched the reservoirs and lakes of the West go dry, we keep watering our lawns, soaking our golf courses, and growing water-thirsty crops. As inflation mounts and the national debt balloons, progressive politicians vote for ever more spending. As the ice caps melt and record temperatures make the evening news, we figure that buying a Prius and recycling the boxes from our daily Amazon deliveries will suffice. When TV news outlets broadcast video after video of people illegally crossing the nation's southern border, many of us change the channel. And when a renowned conservative former federal appellate judge testifies that we already are in a war for our democracy, and that January 6, 2021 was a genuine constitutional crisis, MAGA loyalists snicker that he speaks slowly and celebrate that most people aren't watching. What accounts for the blithe dismissal of potentially cataclysmic threats? The left thinks the right is at fault for ignoring climate change and the attacks on our political system. The right thinks the left is the problem for ignoring illegal immigration and the national debt. But wishful thinking happens across the political spectrum. More and more, we are a nation in denial. I have witnessed, time and again, in myself and in others, a powerful impulse to believe what we hope to be the case. For example, we say, we don't need to cut back on watering because the drought is just part of a cycle that will reverse. With economic growth, the debt will take care of itself. January 6 was just a false flag operation. A classic example of denial comes from Donald Trump when he said, quote, I won in a landslide, unquote. Perhaps this is a branch of the same delusion that leads people to feed money into slot machines. They say, because I really want to win, I believe that I will win. Bolstering our natural inclination towards wishful thinking are carefully constructed, prejudice-confirming arguments from the usual gang of sophists, grifters, and truth deniers. Watching angry commentators on cable news, I'm reminded of H.L. Mencken's observation when he wrote, for every complex problem, there is a solution that is clear, simple, and wrong. When entire countries fail to confront serious challenges, it doesn't end well. During the past half century, we Americans have lived in a very forgiving time, and seeing the world through rose-colored glasses has limited consequences. The climate was stable. Our economy dwarfed the competition. Democracy was on the rise, and our military strength made the U.S. the sole global hyperpower. Today, every one of those things has changed. If we continue to ignore the real threats we face, America will inevitably suffer serious consequences. What clears the scales from the eyes of a nation? Pearl Harbor did. 9/11 did. A crisis can shake the public consciousness, but a crisis may come too late for a course correction that can prevent tragedy. The only cure for wishful thinking is leadership. Winston Churchill emboldened a complacent Britain and rallied the world. Abraham Lincoln held the nation together. Ronald Reagan shook us from our malaise. Lech Walesa inaugurated a movement that brought down the Iron Curtain. Martin Luther King Jr. inspired us to, in his words, believe that unarmed truth and unconditional love will have the final word in reality, unquote. And Volodymyr Zelensky's stunning display of courage when he said, quote, I need ammunition, not a ride, unquote. and showed us what real character looks like. Next on Cross Currents, we'll turn to the editorial and opinion newsletters of the Atlantic Monthly for a follow-up to the Romney column. Published on July 6th, it is written by Tom Nichols. The piece is titled, "Are the Last Rational Republicans in Denial?" Writer Tom Nichols from Chicopee, Massachusetts, is an academic specialist on international affairs and a retired professor at the U.S. Naval War College. In 1991, the last president of the Soviet Union, Mikhail Gorbachev, was briefly deposed in a coup by hardline members of the Soviet Communist Party. Gorbachev, upon his return to Moscow, tried to differentiate between the plotters and the party itself. One of his closest advisors, Alexander Yakovlev, told him that his effort was pointless, akin to, in his words, serving tea to a corpse. Republicans such as Senator Mitt Romney, an honorable man for whom I voted for in 2012, and a handful of others in the GOP, including Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger, should take note of Yakovlev's phrase. Over the weekend, The Atlantic published a plea from Senator Romney for Americans, quote, across the political spectrum, to stop ignoring potentially cataclysmic threats, unquote. The senator from Utah is right to be worried about the detachment of so many Americans. But Romney, Cheney, and Kinzinger cannot rescue the party either, at least not in its current form. In fact, I wonder if the Republicans can ever return to being the kind of party that once nominated someone like Romney for the American presidency. I say this not because of Donald Trump, nor as the apostate Republican I am. The last straw for me was not Trump's election, which I regarded as a fluke, but when Susan Collins lectured America on jurisprudence of Brett Kavanaugh. Likewise, I say this not because I disagree with Republicans on many policy issues. I do. But as a New England Republican who identified with and worked for moderates of a bygone era, I have always had differences with the hard-right social conservatives. Rather, I say this because millions of Republicans seem to have irreversibly lost touch with reality itself. Senator Romney, for his part, seems to share in this concern, but he softens his criticism of his own side with some examples from around the political landscape. "I have witnessed time and again, in myself and others," he writes, "a powerful impulse to believe that what we hope to be is the case, that we don't need to cut back on watering because the drought is just part of a cycle that will reverse itself. With economic growth, the debt will take care of itself. January 6 was a false flag operation." But as the old song from Sesame Street goes, one of these things is not like the other. Unfounded optimism about droughts or recessions is one thing. It's another thing entirely to embrace the idea that an insurrection and an attack on the Capitol was conducted by agents of the United States government itself. At least the false flag assertions fall within what we might call an ordinary, normal even, range of conspiracy theories. Other Republicans have blown past such pedestrian crackpottery and now have escaped the last tendrils of the Earth's gravity. The Republican candidate for Secretary of State in Michigan, for example, believes that people can transmit demonic possession through intimate relations, according to CNN. Meanwhile, Pennsylvania Republicans have nominated a candidate for governor in Doug Mastriano, who has implied that he might invalidate any election result he doesn't like in 2024. And that's probably the least disturbing thing about him. As Jonathan Last put it recently, the Democratic nominee, Josh Shapiro, is an ordinary politician, while Mastriano is, quote, an insane person, a seditionist, a Christian nationalist, a conspiracy nut, unquote. Almost every other national Republican is either silent or on board with the dark fantasies and deepening paranoia that now rule the GOP. For example, Representative Elise Stefanik of New York, the relentlessly ambitious third-ranking House Republican, endorsed the developer, Carl Paladino, for a newly redistricted House seat in the state. In 2021, Paladino said that Hitler was, quote, the kind of leader we need, unquote. Some House Republicans are frustrated that Stefanik went rogue by endorsing Paladino, meaning only that they are embarrassed, but not ashamed. But this internal GOP griping raises a question. When Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin is paddling about in the anti-vaccine fever swamps, and Senate candidate J.D. Vance is cozying up to people like congressional conspiracy theorist Marjorie Taylor Greene and the execrable Matt Gaetz, what exactly counts as going rogue? And how can anyone distinguish it from just another day in the Republican Party? In the end, despite the efforts of Senator Romney and other reasonable Republicans, the fringe is now the base. The last rational members of the GOP, both elected and among the rank and file, need to speak even harsher truths to their own people, as Liz Cheney did last month at the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library. Otherwise, the madness will spread, and our institutions will continue an accelerating slide into a nightmare that will engulf all Americans, regardless of party. Next on Cross Currents, we're turning to the editorial and opinion pages of The Washington Post. This editorial is titled, Think Democracy Isn't Endangered? Just look what happened in Hong Kong. It was no accident that Chinese leader Xi Jinping repeatedly used the word chaos to describe Hong Kong as he marked the July 1st anniversary of the 1997 handover of the former British colony. Mr. Xi vowed that Hong Kong would move, quote, forward from chaos to control, unquote. But what he was really affirming is that China's leaders will not tolerate democracy and its discontents and intend to finish off Hong Kong as a beacon of free thinking and openness. The sight of citizens in the streets demanding their rights to speak freely, which played out in Hong Kong demonstrations in 2019, frightens Mr. Xi and the leadership of one of the most sophisticated authoritarian systems in the world. Mr. Xi declared at the swearing-in of John Lee, the new Hong Kong chief executive who had overseen the harsh police response, said, quote, people have learned the hard way that Hong Kong must not be destabilized and cannot afford to see chaos, unquote. Once upon a time, Hong Kong earned respect for its rule of law and a lively public square. When China took over in 1997, it pledged what it called one country, two systems, under which Hong Kong would retain many freedoms absent on the mainland, including free speech. The autonomy of Hong Kong was supposed to last 50 years, but at the halfway mark, China has brought China much closer to the stifling unfreedom that rules the rest of the country. The turning point was the introduction of a bill on criminal extradition in 2019, under which it was feared anyone could be grabbed and sent to the mainland, lacking rule of law and guarantees of due process. The bill unleashed massive protests, including one in August, in which 200,000 Hong Kongers linked hands to form human chains that stretched for miles. The bill was eventually shelved. A new national security law was imposed on Hong Kong in 2020, with provisions making it easier to prosecute protest and dissent. According to the magazine The Economist, nearly 200 people have been arrested under the national security law, including the prominent newspaper mogul Jimmy Lai. Quote, almost every prominent Democrat in Hong Kong is now either in jail or exile, wrote The Economist. It continues, a culture of fear and reporting has seeped into the civil service, schools, courts, and universities, unquote. Hong Kong residents are encouraged to inform on one another through a tip line, and, quote, a once outspoken legal profession has been neutered, unquote. Teachers, social workers, and labor unions have been brought to heel. As a financial hub and gateway to China, Hong Kong might yet bounce back from pandemic setbacks and closures. But politically, China has smothered it. There's a tendency to dismiss warnings that democracy is threatened around the world, to think that it just can't happen. Take a look at Hong Kong under China's rule. A once vibrant freedom vanished in only a few years. And that is sadly real. Next on Cross Currents, we're turning to the editorial and opinion pages of the New York Times. This column is titled, New Insights into Trump's State of Mind on January 6. It is written by the Times' Peter Baker. He was not speaking metaphorically. It was not an offhand comment. President Donald J. Trump had every intention of joining a mob of supporters he knew to be armed and dangerous as it marched to the Capitol. And there had even been talk of marching into the House chamber himself to disrupt Congress from ratifying his election defeat. For a year and a half, Mr. Trump has been shielded by obfuscations and mischaracterizations, benefiting from uncertainty about what he was thinking on January 6, 2021. If he truly believed the election had been stolen, if he genuinely expected the gathering at the Capitol would be a peaceful protest, the argument went, then how could he be held accountable, much less indicted, for the mayhem that ensued? But for a man who famously avoids leaving emails or other trails of evidence of his unspoken motives, any doubts about what was really going through Mr. Trump's mind on that day of violence seem to have been eviscerated by testimony presented in recent weeks by the House committee investigating the Capitol attack, especially the dramatic appearance of 26-year-old former White House aide who offered a chilling portrait of a president willing to do almost anything to hang on to power. More than perhaps any insider account that has emerged, the recollections of that aide, Cassidy Hutchinson, demolished the fiction of a president who had nothing to do with what happened. Each revelation was stunning on its own. Mr. Trump knew that weapons were in the crowd as he exhorted supporters to, quote, fight like hell, unquote, and even tried to stop anyone from disarming them. He was so determined to join the mob at the Capitol that he lashed out at his Secret Service detail for refusing to take him. And he was so nonchalant about the bedlam that he had unleashed that he suggested Vice President Mike Pence might deserve to be executed. But when added together, the various disclosures have produced the clearest picture yet of an unprecedented attempt to subvert the traditional American democratic process, with a sitting president who had lost at the ballot box planning to march with an armed crowd to the Capitol to block the transfer of power, brushing aside manifold concerns about the potential for violence. Quote, the innocent explanations for Trump's conduct seem virtually impossible to credit following the testimony we have seen, unquote. The words of Joshua Matz, who served as a lawyer for the House Democrats during both the Trump impeachment trials in the Senate. He continued, quote, at the very least, they powerfully shift the burden to Trump and his defenders to offer evidence that he did not act with a corrupt criminal state of mind, unquote. And so nearly 2.5 centuries after the 13 American colonies declared independence from an unelected king, the nation is left weighing a somber new view of the fragility of its democracy and the question of what, if anything, could and should be done about it. To the extent that there may be a turning point in the debate, Ms. Hutchinson's testimony proved decisive for some who had been willing to give Mr. Trump the benefit of the doubt or had been uncertain that the committee had gathered enough evidence about the former president's state of mind. Solomon L. Weisenberg, a former deputy independent counsel under Ken Starr, called her account, in his words, the smoking gun, making a case for, he continues, for his criminal culpability on seditious conspiracy charges, unquote. Mick Mulvaney, who served as Mr. Trump's third White House chief of staff, said he had been defending him. But learning that Mr. Trump knew some in the crowd were armed and still encouraged it to go to the Capitol, he told Fox News, quote, certainly changes my mind, unquote. David French, a conservative critic of Mr. Trump, had been skeptical that the committee would produce sufficient evidence. He wrote, quote, "But Hutchinson's sworn testimony closes a gap in the criminal case against Trump," unquote. He wrote this in The Dispatch, a conservative website. And two law professors, Alan Z. Rosenstein of the University of Minnesota and Jed Handelsman Sugarman of Fordham University, likewise opposed prosecution until seeing Ms. Hutchinson, writing on the Lawfare blog that she changed their minds because she provided, quote, "proof of intent," unquote. The hearings, which will continue after Congress returns on July 11th from its holiday recess, have presented only the prosecution side of the story. With Mr. Trump's acquiescence, Representative Kevin McCarthy of California, the House Republican leader, opted against appointing anyone to the select committee after Speaker Nancy Pelosi rejected a couple of his original selections, leaving the panel composed entirely of Democrats and two Republicans deeply critical of the former president. Neither Ms. Hutchinson nor any of the other witnesses who have testified have been cross-examined. Their testimony has often been presented in short, edited clips rather than in their entirety, and no contrary testimony has been offered publicly. In a courtroom, if it ever comes to that, the case against Mr. Trump will be tested as it has not been so far. Jason Miller, who served as a political advisor to Mr. Trump during and after the election, said, quote, "The committee's presentation has been a purely political exercise, deceptively edited," unquote. Yet, even outside the confines of the hearing room, Mr. Miller and others in Mr. Trump's camp have mainly attacked the committee or tried to chip away at pieces of the testimony rather than produce much of a defense of the former president's actions or an alternate explanation for his state of mind. In his social media posts, Mr. Trump denied asking that armed supporters be allowed at his rally. He wrote, quote, "Who would ever want that? Not me," unquote. He focused more of his energy, though, on castigating Ms. Hutchinson in scathing personal terms, using words like wacko and total phony, and concentrated on one small aspect of her testimony, namely whether he lunged for the wheel of his presidential vehicle when his Secret Service detail refused to take him to the Capitol on January 6. Throughout his time in politics, Mr. Trump has survived one scandal after another, in part because people in authority felt unable to read his mind. Investigators were not sure they could definitively prove that he intended to break the law when he authorized hush money to silence pornographic film actresses, or when he provided false valuations for his properties to lenders, or when he sought to impede the inquiry into Russia's election interference. Fact-checkers similarly documented tens of thousands of false statements he made while in office, but were reluctant to declare that he had knowingly lied. Gwenda Blair, Trump's biographer, referring in turn to Fred Trump and the author of The Power of Positive Thinking, and Senator Joseph McCarthy's red-baiting chief counsel, who became a mentor to Mr. Trump, put it this way, quote, "He learned from Dad, Norman Vincent Peale, and especially Roy Cohn, that you can get away with almost anything if you never back down and insist long enough and loud enough that you're right. And he held on to that right to the final ride." For Mr. Trump, he was being completely consistent with the way he has acted his entire life. Next on Cross Currents, we're turning to the editorial and opinion pages of the Hartford Courant. This opinion column is titled, "Western Nations Are on the Brink of Economic Suicide in Sticking It to Russia." The column is written by Rachel Marsden. She is a columnist, political strategist, and a host of independently produced talk shows in French and in English. Did our leaders even bother to think through all of the potential unintended consequences of picking a fight with Russia over Ukraine? And before anyone says that this is strictly between Russia and Ukraine, the New York Times dispelled that notion, pointing out that the CIA is on the ground inside the country, along with Allied Special Operations Forces, organizing weapons deliveries from Western countries and training Ukrainian fighters. President Joe Biden reportedly told Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin to tone down their overt cheerleading for Ukraine for fear of sparking a direct conflict with Russia, according to NBC News. That might be good advice if Washington wasn't already neck-deep, playing an active role. So, given Washington's direct involvement, who is Biden trying to fool when he keeps blaming high inflation and skyrocketing energy costs, the economic fallout from the conflict, on Russian President Vladimir Putin, as though Washington is a passive victim of unprovoked Russian aggression? "We've never seen anything like Putin's tax on food and gas," Biden said in an address earlier this month. In April, this rhetoric was an easy sell. A whopping 71% of Americans blamed Putin for gas prices at the time, according to an Ipsos poll. But just 2 months later, another survey by Rasmussen has now found that only 11% of Americans blame the Russian leader for their predicament. A majority of 52% of respondents place the fault squarely on Biden and his policies. As this conflict drags on, it becomes increasingly clear that our leaders here in the Western world didn't fully think things through. Their lack of foresight and planning are starting to bite so hard that it's chewing up what's left of our Western industrial landscape. Even the Pentagon isn't immune to the blowback. Hawesville, Kentucky's Century Aluminum plant, a producer of high-grade aluminum used in Navy ships, fighter jets, and the International Space Station, as the largest producer of its kind in North America, gave its 228 employees a 3-day layoff notice, ahead of a 9 to 12-month shutdown, according to Manufacturing Business Technology magazine. The company cited skyrocketing energy costs. It's one thing for Biden to have killed the Keystone XL pipeline in a bone toss to his environmental supporters, but what exactly was the plan for energy independence before cutting off one of the world's top energy suppliers through sanctions? Through their ill-considered sanctions, our leaders jumped out of the plane without a parachute to stick it to Vladimir Putin, with us strapped to their backs, trying to seduce us with their green rhetoric or deflecting blame away from their own actions, as we plummet toward Earth, and reality will do little to save any of us from a hard landing. That's it for today's edition of Cross Currents. Today I've been reading from the editorial and opinion pages of The Hartford Courant, The Atlantic Monthly, The New York Times, and The Washington Post. I'm Jerry Valancourt. So long until next time.